He sure poured a lot into that 6 minutes. I was impressed. So that could be available to you as a teaching tape with your systems, your churches. The other thing that I wanted to mention is it's known among people who have studied Bowen theory that at moments of stuckness or fog or de-energizing state, it can be helpful just to even read a dose of theory, that it just kind of energizes and the brain goes, oh, yeah, I remember that. So just a thought. So this theory can be a partner in understanding and responding to the elephants in the room. Press with vigor on, what an amazing phrase, and that word that contains strength and energy, vitality, there is such life in that word. May Bowen theory contribute to the thoughtful movement of vigor. It seems important tonight to talk about anxiety. Anxiety and fear are generally lurking when elephants are present. Anxiety and relationships seem to go together like peanut butter and jelly. Human beings just don't seem to like the zizz of anxiety. Here is a new look at anxiety. Anxiety is actually an alerting message. It's a source of information. Anxiety was installed in us for survival. Human beings, however, are quite skilled in trying to avoid it. A young professional said, "Busy is my anti-anxiety drug. Getting things done keeps me from thinking about certain issues." This was interesting to learn. The pathways that carry negative information, the anxiety, alerting messages, move twice as fast, and there are twice as many of them in the body. No wonder we feel anxiety so quickly and so intensely. We're hardwired for that, and it's to support us in survival. Marie Bowen and Ed Friedman thought it worthwhile to get a relationship with one's anxiety. One might respond to anxiety by saying, "Thank you for alerting me. Okay, I got the message. Could you quiet down a bit so I can think and respond a little better?" Here's Marie Bowen on anxiety. "You don't have to be totally calm, just be a little calmer than everyone else." And man, that has been really relieving for clergy to hear. Today I'll be mentioning a man by the name of Dr. Balea, who's a neuropsychologist and a neurofeedback therapist. He is actually a favorite speaker among clergy, and some of you have heard him before. He's studied the brain for many, many decades, and he makes his way out into the country listening to all the latest news from neuroscientists, and then he converts it into something practical that all of us can use. He coaches people to partner with their brains so that the brain can be a fuller resource. He talks to his brain. If his brain does something well on his behalf, he is generous and he says, "Thank you, brain." He leaves notes for his brain all over the house, under the telephone, under the pillow. He's quite a remarkable man. He is a great believer in using neutral or positive words to oneself because words have a biochemical effect. And so you can choose your biochemical effect. Here's Dr. Balea on anxiety. Anxiety is power. Beware the leader who is not anxious enough. It is important for the alpha mare or the stallion to have enough anxiety that they are alert to protect the herd. So it has to do with an optimal level of anxiety. So it's almost like being in the ready position with tennis. So on to the elephant in the room. This expression may have begun in 1882 with a short story by Mark Twain entitled The Stolen White Elephant, and then it shows up in the Oxford Dictionary in 1959. So here are some of the things, as if we didn't know. A major problem or controversial issue which is obviously present but is avoided as a subject for discussion. A question, a problem, a solution, or a controversial issue which is obvious to everyone who knows about the situation but is deliberately ignored because to do otherwise would cause great discomfort, embarrassment, or trigger arguments, or simply taboo. The idiom can imply a value judgment that the issue ought to be discussed openly, or it can simply be an acknowledgement that the issue is there and not going to go away by itself. Sometimes it can be a small thing. Oh, it's just a small leak, or it's only a few unhappy people. Ignored in its early stages, this can grow into an elephant, and I'm sure you have encountered situations like that. Sometimes the elephant can actually be talked about, but needed action is missing. Sometimes the elephant is a clear preference that isn't being expressed or stated, as in the Abilene paradox. Likely the room is filled with a herd of elephants. Clergy, staff, and each member of the church have their elephants that they bring into the room, along with all of the elephants in the families of all of those people in the room. So you're beginning to get an image of how many elephants could possibly be in the room. And wouldn't it be interesting to list all the elephants you can possibly think of in your families and in your churches? So as I was preparing this, a few elephants came to me, and one of them was an elephant in my family. Is when I was 16 as a teenager, I ran away from home. And what precipitated that is that my dad, who was a loving and ordinarily a reasonable man, got really mad at my boyfriend, who he really didn't like, because the boyfriend peeled out of the driveway and scattered most of the gravel from the driveway into the lawn, which was one of my father's treasured possessions. So his response to that was to forbid me to ever see this boyfriend again. So that seemed like an unreasonable request, so my response to it was, I'm running away. So, you know, in reflection, there's a bigger context to that event. And the context is, I was 16, and when my dad was 16, he encountered the untimely, very visible death of his dad, which was very difficult for him. And that death was associated with his sister marrying a man that her father did not approve of. So you get the bigger picture of this. And so I think it's really important to think about the larger context and the larger system around an elephant, be it in one's family or in the church. So Dr. Belay is a great believer in writing, so I thought I would ask you to take out a piece of paper and write down one elephant that lives inside you. Then write one elephant that lives in your family and one that lives in your church. And just do it really quickly. You can always return to it if nothing comes to mind. Nothing's coming to mind. Brain buttons may stimulate some blood into the brain, bringing some information. As you're writing about those elephants, if there are some ideas about context, you could just write those in alongside, just to jog your memory when you come back to this, if you wish to. So I'm going to move on. Anxiety and fear seem to stop people from talking and thinking creatively about the elephant in the room. The amygdala, has anybody heard about the amygdala? There's a lot of brain science lately, so people are getting acquainted with this inner equipment that we've had. The amygdala is part of the inner brain. Some people describe that as the emotional brain. And it's the part of our brain that is constantly scanning the environment. Am I safe? Am I not safe? Is there danger? Is there not danger? So that's going on our behalf all the time. And it's also asking the question, will I die? Is there so much danger I could die? Am I at risk? So it's the amygdala that makes the initial decision. No, it is too dangerous to move toward this. So it may be the amygdala that's making some of the decisions about how people move or don't move toward the elephant in the room. Why would anybody want to talk about an anxious topic when there is already enough anxiety? Thank you, just the same. A committee at church was given the task of talking about racial issues. The church had become more racially mixed with a variety of different cultures. There were three facilitators in this group. At one point, a woman stood up and said, "I think black people should get over this slavery thing. After all, they were clothed, fed, and taken care of." What happened next? Silence. After the meeting, fortunately, the facilitators went to the senior minister. They had twisted and stewed with anxiety. What could they say? What should they have said? Should they say anything? Was this within the scope of their responsibility? The senior minister with their new black associate gathered them together to plan calmly and clearly for the next step. This just happened, so I don't know what has evolved. This is a powerful story. It teaches three things: the effects of anxiety, and there are states of anxiety where people lose the capacity to speak, to hear, to see, and to take action. When human beings are stressed, they can lose these capacities. And then the second important thing, and fortunately these facilitators created a triangle by going to the senior minister, which was a positive triangle. So that movement in triangles is really important. And then the third, there is usually a chance, another chance, to move toward the issue again, which will be happening in this church. How curious it is that the elephant, not an alligator or a hippopotamus, has been chosen to represent the anxious, avoided issue in the room. Elephants have been revered and respected throughout history. They are respected for their memory, and a long memory it is, as their ancestors lived 5 million years ago. They are intelligent and have deep commitments to each other. The ancients believed that elephants represent strength, gentleness, patience, discernment, compassion, and get this, the removal of obstacles and barriers. The ancients thought that elephants could teach us how gentleness, commitment, and communication are necessary to keep relationships alive, trusting, and loving. Naming is so important. Naming the elephant in the room is important. And it might be of use to include the elephant as teacher in that naming. Dr. Balea believes naming something in the most neutral way begins to de-ziz an issue. So he might suggest starting out with, it seems that there is something in the air. Pretty neutral. Neutrality is quieting. This is going to seem odd. Neutrality and its quieting may take out some of the seriousness surrounding the elephant. Anxiety breeds seriousness. Too much seriousness feeds in more anxiety. A senior minister will be going to a 5-day leadership event. Her associate with 25 years at the church was recently asked to leave because of unprofessional behavior and angrily refusing to work with the senior minister, a younger woman. This former associate will also be at this event, and it's a very small event. There will be 15 people at this event. So you get the picture. The senior minister knows that when she arrives that her colleagues are going to want to talk to her about this, what has happened. This is what she plans to say. Yes, a lot has happened, and it is hard right now. We are finding our way and learning. We are hopeful for the future. Notice how she acknowledges what has happened in abstract terms and puts a container around it. She plans to concentrate on connecting with her body, anticipating that her insides will tighten at least 15 times when she sees her former associate. She plans to log in each time when that happens. The first one has happened, and there'll be 14 more. So she's in this position of observing herself in the process around her. She plans to log this in, and she plans to place her hands on her abdomen, which is where the tightening happens, and to breathe slowly. Notice how she predicts that she will feel anxiety and has a plan for sitting with it. When she returns, she plans to mention the former, indicating this is somebody who can be talked about. The senior has decided to hang pictures of all formers. There is no wall of formers. So she's decided to put all of them up in addition to this former associate to acknowledge the facts of the past. Someone has suggested making a scrapbook of the former's contributions. These are all interesting ways of naming this elephant of contribution, tension, relief, and grief. Here is another example of a neutral beginning. There is an important issue that has been sitting before us. It might be of use to study it and learn from it. So that's kind of a different positioning in a relationship with this elephant. I want to talk a little bit about preparation because it's so very important. Olympic athletes always prepare for an event. They build up their stamina, they eat well, they work with their anxiety, they work with their thinking. No Olympic athlete would ever consider going into an event without preparation. Yet human beings go into the equivalent of Olympic events every day without preparation. These might include family visits, tender issues, important meetings. If people do prepare, they often focus on the what I will do, the content of a sermon, the content of a presentation, the content of a conversation. Often less thought goes into how do I prepare my internal state for the how I want to be. The process. Preparing is like sending a small child off on a really cold winter day to school, protected and ready with a hat and coat and mittens. The rector entered the sanctuary before morning service. He found the clergy intern sitting in a pew. Her faith experience was deep, growing up as the daughter of a world spiritual leader. The rector asked her, "What are you doing?" She said, "I'm preparing the sanctuary." She did this for 20 minutes before each service. Dr. Balea believes in the sacredness of his work. He greets each client before they arrive at the office. He prepares the space for their visit. As you know, prayer is such a powerful and beautiful way of preparing, especially the kind that includes talking and listening to God in silence. For some, prayer is an underutilized resource. Preparation before moving toward an elephant makes sense. They're big and they're wild. Once, while snowmobiling with some friends in Yellowstone National Park, we discovered a shaggy buffalo immobilized, stuck in the snow up to her shoulders with her sweet little calf standing next to her. The rest of the herd had left them. It was painful to watch. My gene for rescuing animals called to my friends, "Come on, let's dig her out." They rolled their eyes and walked away. "Okay then, I'll do it myself." Determined and without any preparation, I walked toward her, getting ready to dig. As I got closer, her breathing got rapid, her nostrils flared, and her eyes got big. And I thought to myself, oh no, I'm going to give her a heart attack trying to rescue her. Maybe this is not such a good idea. So I slowly backed away, thinking, I'm going to go tell the ranger she needs some help. My friends admonished, "Are you crazy? You could have gotten killed." In a later phone call, only my dad, who had bestowed the animal rescue gene in me, laughed with respect and appreciation. The big brown buffalo demonstrated how breathing changes with danger. Breathing rapidly and shallowly brings tension into the body more anxiety, and more reactive responses. Breathing that is slower, deeper, and conscious invites a powerful way to prepare and to bring more internal quiet. A breathing practice is like a savings account. It offers a place of stability and peacefulness to draw on when life speaks loudly. Oh no, you might be thinking, not one more thing. Well, one of the nice things about spending so much time in the car is it's a great chance to work with breath. A recent article written by a bishop out in Chicago called The Breath of Life describes his thinking. As my life becomes more complicated and my responsibilities more nuanced and complex in my spiritual work, I am drawn increasingly to the most simple and profound of all spiritual practices, breathing. Ancients believe that God is present in each breath. Some believe that God lives in the space between the in-breath and the out-breath. The breath connects one with self, the environment, with life, and with God. The breath is what separates us from death. How profound to register a loved one breathing one moment and then not the next. Everything is changed. Mindful breathing changes things too. It enlivens the brain, the whole body. It enlivens a life. Mindful breathing is a discipline, the practice of paying attention to the breath. With awareness, the breath will just naturally slow and deepen, bringing more oxygen to the brain. The brain just loves oxygen. Tightness in the body and rapid, shallow breathing result in oxygen deprivation. And when the brain gets a sense that it's being deprived of oxygen just as a result of breathing changes, it gets worried. And anxiety moves in. And so this describes the physical component of anxiety. It's related to oxygen deprivation. And then when a person becomes aware of that anxiety, sometimes the thinking is, uh-oh, things are worse than I thought. And the breathing becomes more rapid and more shallow. There's less oxygen in the body. And that cycle of anxiety, both physical and emotional, keeps spinning. So the nice thing about getting oxygen, more oxygen into the body, it actually softens the body, it lessens muscle tension. It quiets the mind so that responses can be softer and clearer. How many of you have experienced conscious breathing? Okay, large majority. Let's just take a few moments and invite that in now, getting yourself into a comfortable position with your feet flat on the floor. And just notice your breath moving in and moving out. Noticing yourself as you're noticing your breath. And then gently opening your eyes whenever you're ready. So some of you may experience doing this already, but one can do conscious breathing in the middle of a presentation. I've been doing it up here. One can do it in a meeting. So there are lots of really crafty ways of sneaking it in, and nobody needs to know that you're doing it. So I'd like to talk a little bit about cultivating a relationship with an elephant in the room. There are three elements that have already been mentioned: getting acquainted with theory, regulating one's anxiety, and preparing. So I'd like to talk about some of the ideas that Murray Bowen and Ed Friedman have, and also Dr. Belay, about relating to an elephant. Ed Friedman and Murray Bowen, along with Dr. Belay, hold the title Masters of the Indirect. All three share being savvy and touching brains in a really subtle way. Bowen thought that confrontation stirred up too much anxiety and it made good thinking harder. So he was not a fan of confrontation, and that was also radical back in the 60s and 70s. Ed would say, "All I'm doing is offering an invitation for people to be more of a self or more mature." All three hold that going in the side door or the back door is more productive often than going in the front door. Ed acknowledged that the front door may work in 20% of situations, but it's interesting how come a person can't say, "You know, sweetheart, you just don't tell me you love me enough." Rarely does the other person say, "You know what, honey, you're absolutely right, and I'm going to start today." Have you noticed that? There is an artistry to the indirect approach. Once in a coaching session with me, Ed suggested one of those craftily radical ideas that I might say to my mother. And I have to say, the elephant in the room of my timidness responded. And I said to him, "I could never say that. That would stick in my throat." And his response was, "It's like murder after the first time. It gets easy." So he captured the bigness of change, and he actually captured that having said that would have metaphorically murdered my mother. Sometimes humans have an unreasonable faith in talking things out. It is important to know that shifts come without talking. A man with a significant practice of self-awareness was walking up the path to the beach. And his wife had said something, and he's in his head thinking, "I can't believe that my wife would say such a thing." And then he says, "I can't believe that I'm married to somebody who would say such a thing." And then the next thought came is, "I'm not at all sure that I want to be married to somebody who would say such a thing." And then the next thought came, and it was, "You know what? You've had these thoughts before." And then the next thought came, and it was, "And you know what? You're going to have them again." And with that, he sat down in his beach chair, and the anger just kind of moved out from him on down the beach. And within minutes of that, his wife got up out of her beach chair and came over and kissed him. So healing brought to the self, brought to a person, brought to a situation can be healing. Differences in people may be food for the elephant in the room. John Gottman is a really well-respected long-term studier of marriage. He's probably studied marriage the longest of anybody in our country. He believes that there are issues in marriages that will never be resolved. I see some nodding. And I can't tell you how relieving it has been for couples to hear this because they think there's something wrong with them. You know, we haven't been able to talk this through. We haven't been able to resolve it. And then they find out that this is just plain normal. And many of these couples go on to think about these differences in such a way that they can live with each other peacefully. Murray Bowen says that it takes a lot of maturity to deal with the differences in other people. Shortly after relocating to a church, an Episcopal rector and his wife were given a celebration for their 20th anniversary. And at this celebration, one of the oldest members of the church came up to the wife and said, "Dearie, what would you attribute the longevity of your marriage to?" And the spunky wife said, "That's easy, lust and learning to love the things you can't stand about the other person." So obviously, change is complex, and it can take a while. So here are some thoughts that come from Bowen and from Ed Friedman about a relationship with an elephant. When an issue is emotional, getting one's anxiety lower is essential. The second is best to move slowly. The third is to gather facts, and that's one of the underpinnings of Bowen theory, is to get factual information. Who, what, where, when, how are questions that Bowen and Ed would ask, rather than why questions. And then this idea of becoming more neutral, neither overly positive nor overly negative. And then also being able to see, I'm not ready for Dr. Belay yet. Okay. The other part is to be able to see the elephant or the symptom as something much larger. With this context, how does the symptom or the elephant bring information about the larger system? And then lastly, this idea about going in the side door or the front door rather than the front door can reap much better benefits. So part of Ed Friedman's advice to people was to figure out your natural inclinations and then do the exact opposite. In 1991, I had to have a breast biopsy, and so I was thinking about calling my mother, and I knew it would make her anxious, and then I was already anxious enough, and I thought, oh, no, I'm going to have to deal with her anxiety. She's going to be calling me every day. So I thought, well, I'll call her, and I'll downplay it. So I talked to Ed about it, and he said, oh, I'd go in the opposite direction. I'd beam in there with all the anxiety you've got. What? So I called her up, and I said, I've got something to tell you that's making me so anxious I want to crawl out of my skin. And then I told her, and she listened for a while, and she said, I don't think you have cancer. And I said, really? How come? I don't know. I just don't think you have it. So after about five more minutes, she said to me, well, let's talk about Christmas. Do you want to come up here, or do you want us to come down here? And I went, what? She's done talking about this? And she was. She was done. She didn't call me every day. So it was a big surprise, and I think going in the opposite direction moved me to claim my own space and to get out of her space. So here's, I have to point this in the right direction. Nope. Okay, here we go. So here's Dr. Belaya on elephants. He thinks elephants are big animals and that it's important to respect their size. He said if you poke at it in the wrong way, the results may not be positive. And then, you know, he certainly says there is often more than one elephant in the room, which we've talked about. And then he has this idea about moving gently toward the elephant, make friends with it, which is such an interesting concept. He then goes on to say, respect the power of something that has been long established. You don't dare change quickly an old habit or an issue that has lived on for a long time. And then he thinks it's really important to ask questions. How did the elephant come to be here? He thinks that elephants can be challenged in certain circumstances, and that human beings hold rules in the right side of their brain that influence how people respond to elephants, such as the rule, I can't put myself at risk. Talking about hard things has never turned out well. And then lastly, depending on the rules in the brain, success can be one of the more difficult elephants to deal with, which was really curious to hear. People can be so good at figuring it out, they don't see that there are other alternatives. As many of you know who has studied Bowen theory, cutoff is part of Bowen's concepts. Cutoff is a way of managing intensity, and I think cutoffs are a part of the elephant in the room. Paradoxically, it uses up more energy to avoid something than it does to move toward it. It's an interesting concept. This is a really important story, and it was something that I heard recently. A new minister arrives at a new church, and in the first committee meeting, they talk about removing a small sapling from the parking lot, and there's this huge explosion. The next day, the same thing, small issue, big explosion. And the third day, it happens again. So he thinks, well, maybe they're just getting used to missing their prior minister, and they're getting used to me. So he decides to do some research and finds out that his predecessor, after 25 years, was forced to resign. So he decides that, well, let me back up. At the same time, he's working with a leadership coach, and the leadership coach suggests that he get connected with a sister with whom he's been cut off. He left college and just wanted to leave hometown and the family behind, so he cut off. So he invites the sister to come for a visit. Then he finds this former minister, and the minister is actually dying, and he starts visiting him and relays in a neutral, calm way information about the church. Then he comes back to the church, and he relays information about the former to church members. They start visiting, and what they say to him is, we thought about being in contact with him, but it's been very uncomfortable for us, and you seem so at ease with him. So the visiting continues, and then when Reverend Thompson dies, the funeral is held at the church. The portrait hallway of formers had not held Reverend Thompson's picture, and several weeks later, there's a ceremony, the hanging of the Thompson, as the new minister called it. The Reverend Thompson's family attended, and here's this quote from this minister. Words fail to describe what I believe happened that day, but it seemed as if a rip in the space-time continuum was healed. The ceremony and ritual around this reconnection mattered more than I knew. And this is the big one. Though you will never find work at healing cutoffs in a book on how to grow a church, I believe it made a difference. Visitors began to join, and a sense of joy emerged in the church and me. Energy was released. So I know that time is running out. I had planned to talk a little bit about the silence, both differentiating the silence of avoidance and the silence of awareness and connection, and how they reap such different things. So sometimes talking about the elephant can be just the right thing. Ed believed that being able to talk about something would release the demons in it. Dr. Balea suggests that writing down all the negative things, things you're sure you don't want to say, putting those down, getting a space for the no's that make way for all the yeses, and then to write down what you want to say and when. So I just want to relay one more story, and that has to do with the power of humor can be such a great companion in relating to elephants. In preparing for her sabbatical, a clergy person noticed that the church was becoming more agitated, more than she anticipated, as she planned for this sabbatical. She began asking questions about the sabbaticals of her predecessors and learned that her immediate predecessor had called in at the end of the sabbatical and said, "I'm not coming back. I'm going to be a real estate agent." Knowing this, she said to the church, "You know I'll be going on my sabbatical soon. I ask one thing of you. If you're planning to put your house on the market, please wait until I come back." The church erupted in hilarious laughter, loosening up this delicate thing. She also knew that by sending periodic "I'm thinking of you" postcards would quiet even more anxiety and lubricate the pathways for her return. So in closing, elephants, when acknowledged and respected, can be rich teachers. Often they hold the memory of a church, the matriarchs and the patriarchs. Awareness is healing. Ed Friedman called this the power of presence. Sometimes this has a contagious effect. It can convert a major issue into a minor issue. Often what appears to be a huge, insurmountable mountain of a barrier is tissue paper thin and can be walked right through. In the presence of awareness, elephants often walk away, disappearing without protest. Connecting with elephants. And the forces surrounding liberates everyone, making vigor possible. The energy delivered up can be used for such big, important things. Connecting with elephants and each other allow a church to live in new life and draw new life to it.